Our first speaker this morning is our brother Stephen Hornhart from Salisbury, Adelaide, South Australia Ecclesia. And we're certainly very happy to have brother Stephen and his sister wife Christine with us this week. Brother Stephen's theme for his classes is Come and See, Witnessing for Christ. And today's class is entitled Judgment on Pagan Rome, Seals 1 and 2. We'll call upon our brother Stephen at this time.
Well, thank you, Brother Greg, and good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ, and of course our dear young people. Very nice to be with you as we commence our first class, as Brother Greg said, under the general theme, Come and See, Witnessing for Christ, and Seals 1 and 2, Judgment on Pagan Rome. Now, some of us weren't here on Saturday evening, and on Saturday evening we presented this slide that we had before us there. We made the point, reminding ourselves, the apocalypse is made up of three major sections, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials. And when you open the seventh seal in chapter 8 and verse 1, that seventh seal containing the trumpets and the vials and the thunder judgments in the seventh vial, we might add, that seventh seal runs right through to the beginning of the millennium, as does the seventh trumpet, as does the seventh vial, all culminating as the millennium is about to begin. We made the point on Saturday evening that the sections out of this broad sweep of the apocalypse that we'll be considering are chapter 6, which contains the first six seals. We'll then dip into a portion of the seventh seal, which we will see the Germanic barbarians who are there on the border of the Rhine and the Danube and can't wait to come in and to gobble up this old, shuffly, pale, greeny, yellow, chloritic horse, which is the fourth seal. So we're going to move into chapter 8 in the latter part of this week and have a look at the Visigoths and the Vandals and the Huns and the Ostrogoths and all of the remarkable material, the drama of Revelation chapter 8. Well, seals 1 and 2 are our brief this morning, and we are invited. In fact, you would have noticed in the reading that on a number of occasions, the invitation to John and to you and I is, come and see. So we're going to accept that invitation this week. Now, brothers and sisters, young people, this expression, come and see, is only used four times in chapter 6. And it only is used with relationship to the four horses. So you have come and see in chapter 6 and verse 1. You have it in chapter 6 and verse 3. You have the same expression with respect to the third horse, the black horse, in verse 5. And you have it in verse 7 with respect to the pale horse. Why? Why isn't the invitation, one of the living ones said to John in the fifth seal, John, come and see the souls under the altar as they cry to Almighty God. Why isn't the invitation there with the sixth seal, the great earthquake? Why isn't the invitation given in the seventh seal in chapter 8 and verse 1? Why these four and only these four? Well, you know, the answer starts tumbling out when you have a look at the other expression that is actually connected to this expression, come and see. Now, I know you won't be able to see that text. If you can, your eyes are absolutely, you're full of eyes, as the apocalypse says. Now, you can't see the text, but if you've got a King James version of the Bible, the Oxford, you'll see the colours. Now, you can see there what we've got in red. You can see the colour, come and see in verse 3, come and see in verse 5, and likewise come and see in verse 7. Why? Well, let's couple the other expression that is only used four times in this chapter, couple that with it, and that starts to allow us to unravel the question, or the answer to the question. You see, the other expression is, I heard one of the four beasts. Again, with the second seal, one of the four beasts said to John enthusiastically, energetically, John, come over here, stand next to us, and be a spectator. So in the first four seals, John is invited to align himself with these beasts. Now, some of us in the audience would know, but of course, we're not talking about the earth beast, the sea beast, the image of the beast of Revelation 13. We're talking about living ones. I mean, that's Revelation 4, isn't it? And verse 4 through 7. The Greek for beast is the Greek word zoa, and it means a living one. And these are the cherubim. And if we go to Revelation chapter 4, there we have pictorially represented, we've got these 24 elders. They surround the throne, and there is a flat sea of glass. 24 elders, brothers and sisters, young people, that's you and me, God willing, in the age to come, in our kingly and priestly role. But our role as kings and priests will only take place subsequent to the sea being made flat. Who's going to do that? The four living ones of Revelation 4. And you'll notice with Revelation 4 and the four living ones, the lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle, the cherubim, you notice that they've each got six wings in chapter 4, each of them. Ah, that's aligning to the seraphim of Isaiah 6. Seraphim, burning, burning. So what we have in Revelation 4, brothers and sisters, is you have each of these four living ones with six wings, 24 in all. Ah, now there's the connection to the 24 elders. So you see different works of the saints in the age to come. And the four living ones with their burning are going to bring judgment on the earth so that the world becomes flat like glass in order that we can then take up the next role after judging the world, which will be reigning as kings and priests, the 24 elders. So, John is told, John, these four living ones in chapter 6 are cherubim. They are vehicles of God manifestation. They are the saints of which John is part. John, you belong with us because your work is going to be the six-winged creatures who are going to bring a glassy sea. That's where you're going to be in the future, John. So stand with us and watch how this work begins 2,000 years before it will end. Be a spectator. You're going to be a doer later, John, when we make this sea like glass. But at the moment, you're going to be a spectator as you watch the work of the angel. So, John, come over here and see. What do you think of the white horse? Amazing. John, what do you think of this blood red horse? Amazing. What do you think of the black horse? Oh, awful, but amazing. What do you think of the pale horse? Oh, worse, but amazing. This is the beginning of the work, John. Why is it not, therefore, extended to the fifth seal or the sixth seal? Well, in the first four seals, the object that John is a spectator of is Rome. When you come to the fifth seal, the object shifts from the Roman Empire and the object becomes the brothers and sisters. Who would want to enthusiastically, energetically be invited to come and see the persecution of the brothers and sisters? That would be awful. But there's another reason, brethren and sisters, as to why the invitation to come and see and the four living ones does not exist with the fifth and the sixth seal. No come and see, no living ones, because by the time we get to the fifth seal, we are approaching AD 300. 12 years away is the man-child Constantine, who is the champion of the apostasy. We're only 12 or so years away from the world being soaked with the apostasy that has been developing and bubbling for 300 years. And therefore, when God looks down from heaven, as we approach the fifth seal, as we approach 300 AD, where are the cherubim? Where are the brothers and sisters? Where are the cherubic figures as we approach the fifth seal, AD 300? Oh, there's a few over there. Oh, there's a little pocket over there. But where are they? They've been gobbled up by Rome. And therefore, because there is not a significant number of brethren and sisters, the truth has been well and truly in decline while the apostasy has been embellished and flourishing. And therefore, brothers and sisters and young people, because there is not enough of the brothers and sisters, wherever you look, all you can see is the apostasy. God does not deem it fit to therefore introduce the fifth, nor the sixth, nor the seventh seal with one of the living ones said, come and see. What an amazing thing, brothers. All right, well, now we zip into the... how's our time going? Got to get used to this clock. Okay, I can see that all right. Okay, now we're looking at the first four seals. And this morning, particularly seals 1 and 2. God willing, tomorrow morning, seals 3, 4 and 5. And we will find, brothers and sisters, that tomorrow morning will be particularly and peculiarly exhortational. A little bit of history this morning. So I hope you're not really anti-history, but we need to pick up some of the thrusts of the history as they apply to both seals 1 and 2. Well, many of us are aware that with our first seal, the white horse is a symbol of peace. We'll touch on that as we look at the appropriate verses. You'll notice with the red horse, we've got blood, and this would be 31 years as the Roman Empire, the pagan empire, plummets from a very stable, relatively politically and economically, time of prosperity in the White Horse period. You'll find that the Roman Empire plummets into 31 years of civil war. And from that 31 years of civil war, then Rome would fall into 24 years of awful famine, which would then bring on disease and chaos. And then the Roman Empire is on its last breath, because you get to the fourth seal and you see that the title we put there is death, but really in the scriptures it's not death, it's the name death. And when you get to the fourth seal, brothers and sisters, the pagan Roman Empire is like a skinny old shuffly horse, hardly able to move. It's in its death throes before the barbarians would sweep across the border and take that empire. Now look at the badge of the riders. You'll find that the badge of the white horse is a bow without an arrow. It's just, you'd go to war with a bow without an arrow. You'd be spoken to by your superiors, I tell you. I mean, how potent is a bow without an arrow? What do? Get up close and hit people over the head with a bow? What good is a bow without an arrow? Is this an impotent weapon? No way, brothers and sisters. No way. When we have a look at the meaning of this bow without an arrow, it is as potent as you could ever have a weapon. And it does something totally different to any weapon that has ever been produced or developed or invented or used. When you have a look at the badge of the second rider, it's the sword. Now, that sword there is just far, far too long. I mean, from a perspective point of view, I suppose the artist did that. But that sword that rider is carrying is the Machaira Magalia, which is the little stabbing stick. It's the little assassin's dagger. It's the little dagger where you get the expression cloak and dagger. I mean, all the emperors had them. The Praetorian Guard had them. The Senate had them. We have our cell phones. When we get into trouble, but they had their little Machairas, you see. And so that one's far too long. It should be a little dirk, a little stabbing stick. I mean, dearie me, brothers and sisters, if you had one of those, you'd assassinate yourself every time you sat down. So that's far too long, far too long indeed. So the badge of the rider was the Machaira, the assassin's dagger, in 31 years. These men who ruled over Rome boasted in peace. And they themselves would take it away. And blood would flow through the streets of Rome with alacrity. And any time, brothers and sisters, you wanted to go to Rome in this period of time, don't. If ever you wanted to go to the marketplace to buy food, forget it. Because there was very common in Rome at this time, it was not uncommon to see 2,000 people a day dying in the streets of Rome. 2,000 a day. Such was the chaos in this blood, fiery red period of the Roman Empire. The badge of the rider on the black horse is a pair of balances, and Rome boasted in justice. Well, there was no justice with Rome, let me tell you. And of course, our rider, or the badge of the rider, is the name death. All right, brothers and sisters, something to tidy up with respect from the point of view of a little technical nature. Just understand this. When we look at these horses, although the horse was a very fitting symbol for Rome, no question of that, as was the eagle. But understand this as we walk through our studies. The earth is the Roman Empire. The horse and its colour is the condition of the Roman Empire at a given time. And the rider is the reason for the colour or the condition. I'll just flip that slide off and come back to it. Now, there's an example in chapter 6. Six times you have the earth, you see. So the earth, the fourth part of the earth, that's the Roman Empire. So flicking back to our other slide, the earth is the empire. The horse clomping across the earth is the condition of the empire with its colour. And the rider is the reason for that particular colour or problem with the Roman Empire. Having said that, brothers and sisters, let's now launch into our first seal. We read in verse 1, Revelation chapter 6. How's everybody doing out there? This is the fresh class, isn't it? Hey? All got your coffees? You've all had a good sleep? Shall we wear you all out in the first class and just make it tough for the other two speakers that come on? I think we should, actually. I want you all to have your heads on your arms and just shaking them after this class. And that will really inspire Jace as he comes in for his second class. All righty, Revelation 6 and verse 1. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. Seven seals. The only one that's introduced with the noise of thunder is seal 1. Why? Well, you know, brothers and sisters, Brother Thomas translates that way, as the diaglot does. And we read this with respect to this noise. I heard one of the four living ones saying, as with the voice of thunder. Now, this is designed to mentally and emotionally arrest John. This clap of thunder, or this voice of thunder, would be an utterance from the Senate of Rome, as also it would be from the cherubic figures. And it was designed to make you sit up with absolute interest and keenness as to what has just happened. And so dramatic was this voice of thunder. And historically, brothers and sisters, this is what happened. Now, there are your first five emperors of the first seal, or all of the five emperors, we should say, of the first seal: Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antonius Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. Now, the emperor before the first... Whoops, we've lost our screen. How are you doing there? Is it plugged in? Screensaver, let's just do something here. Should we touch some buttons? How about we push that? We've just changed the slide. I'm timing this. I'm not going to be robbed of these minutes, let me tell you. No way. Clock is ticking. Yeah. Have you got these? Have you all got these on your own laptops? We good? Pardon me? We're back on? Okay, what should we chat about, brothers and sisters? How was your night? Any questions thus far?
I would suggest it was one of the other speakers when you said you were going
to... I know. Where is Jace? Where are you, mate? Show yourself. Don't you touch any of the power there, buddy. I know it's not Garth because he's next door, hopefully. Is he? No, he's not. His head's under the door. Well, I'll have a glass of water. They don't get it fixed in, 15 minutes. We'll carry on. I suppose we will. I'll just have a little bit of... We'll probably do some speaking and chatting to you about the events of the history. We probably don't need the slides up there. Has this ever happened before, Dan at Shippensburg? Never? Yeah, the voice of thunder. It was indeed. Oh, it's coming back. We're good. Oh dear, where were we? Pardon me? Dan needed the exercise, didn't he? He was sitting up there far too long. Okay, back online. Well done. You owe me 3 minutes and 30 seconds, Dan. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, this noise of thunder, it was mentally and emotionally arresting. No other seals would be introduced by the noise of thunder. Now, with those five emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius, before Nerva came on the scene in the first seal, the emperor before that was the emperor Domitian. Hard, cruel, insane Domitian. Now, Domitian was the son of Vespasian. And you may remember that Vespasian marched on Jerusalem, was pulled back to settle affairs in Rome with the passing away of the emperor, and then Vespasian sent his son Titus in AD 70. Now, Titus was the older brother of Domitian. And so Domitian walked in the shadow of his great older brother, and therefore historians tell us that Domitian had a king-size inferiority complex, and that outworked in his character. And Domitian hated Christians, hated them. And he hated anything Jewish. The Senate did not like Domitian. And Domitian's wife was frightened of Domitian because Domitian's wife leaned toward Christianity. And so therefore, when she plotted the assassination and successfully achieved that of her husband Domitian, there was a great cry from the Senate. He's gone. And they tore down all the things that Domitian had done and endeavoured to erase his memory out of Rome's grapes. So there was Domitian, brothers and sisters and young people, after the same stamp as the Emperor Nero. And when Domitian was taken, woof, like that, like a great sound of thunder or the voice of thunder, in came a period of the Roman Empire over which Nerva reigned that was like black and white. It was like night and day, the contrast. And it was like the angels were saying to John, John, just as we now pop the first seal and begin this great 2,000-year scroll, I want you to be encouraged by this. This is the beginning of the end of this monster called Rome. But that very first emperor that would reign in the first seal and this white horse period, by contrast to the blackness of Domitian, would be like the kingdom. Because at the end of it all, another white horse appears in Revelation 19. And Jesus Christ and you and I will ride white horses. Not a Roman horse on that occasion, an Israelitish horse. So it's almost like a very mini cameo of the kingdom to come. All of those in the age to come who are haters of Christians and who are haters of the Jews will be wiped out with a voice of thunder. And a white horse will emerge. A little cameo, therefore, brothers and sisters, of this noise of thunder. Well, we read in verse 2, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him. Now, we've talked about, albeit very briefly, that the white horse is a symbol of peace. We know that. Let's have a read of verse 4. Simply by a little bit of a mathematical deduction, we look at Revelation chapter 6 and verse 4, and we read, and there went out another horse that was red, and power was given unto him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. Alrighty? So peace had existed prior to the red horse, and therefore that gives us suitable justification to say quite clearly, biblically, that this white horse was a symbol of peace. But note that the rider, brothers and sisters, had a bow. Now, what I want to do is to walk you through these three quotations very, very quickly and build up this biblical picture of the expression, the bow, and what the bow meant. Could you know better than go to Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 13 as one of those quotations? So come with me, if you will, to Zechariah and chapter 9 and verse 13. What is this bow? This 84-year period of relative peace and security in the Roman Empire. Doesn't mean to say that our brothers and sisters weren't to be persecuted, or they were, particularly through the Emperor Trajan, who was one of the emperors of the first seal. But in Zechariah 9, we read these words with respect to the bow. Verse 13, Zechariah 9. Now, we are in the context of post-Armageddon. Armageddon has passed. There we are. We are endeavouring now to set events in motion that will create the sea to become flat like glass, that we might then become the 24 elders of Revelation 4. Well, verse 13, and when I have bent Judah for me and filled the bow, filled the Judah bow with Ephraim. So here we are in Zechariah 9, post-Armageddon, and we've got the bow in the hand of God. It is a multitude. It's the whole house or tribe of Judah. And here this Judah bow, this multitude, is filled with the Ephraim arrow. And these are the 10 tribes. And therefore, brothers and sisters, when the Lord Jesus Christ returns, he will save Judah first, those that are in the land at his coming. And then he will save Ephraim, those that are scattered abroad, who will then fight their way back to the land. So what we have as we build up this little picture, we have in Zechariah 9 and 13 that a bow is a multitude. And that's very relevant to this first seal of the apocalypse. And then if we turn our minds to Isaiah 66, we read these words again, post-Armageddon. So if we turn over to Isaiah 66, same context as Zechariah 9. Now this verse 19 of Isaiah 66 has given the translators a lot of difficulty. They've had a lot of headaches over this verse because of the multitude of italics, you see. So read this verse, a tricky verse for some. Verse 19, post-Armageddon. Same context as Zechariah 9, verse 19, Isaiah 66. I will set a sign among them. I will send those that escape of them to the nations. Pause. I am going to send those that escape. Who are they? Well, they're going to go to Tarshish, they're going to go to Pul, they're going to go to Lud. Who are they? They are those that draw the bow. What are they going to do, these drawers of the bow? Well, at the end of the verse, they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. So what they're going to do, brothers and sisters and young people, these people are going to be sent and they're going to bend their tongues like a bow and they're going to declare the glory of God. Out of their mouth is going to go the sweet words of the covenant of Almighty God. Now, Brother Thomas translates that verse, Isaiah 66 and verse 19, this way. I will send those that escape of them sound as of the truth, and they will declare my glory among the nations. Bow benders. So therefore, brothers and sisters and young people, building up this little dossier of evidence, we've got a bow is a multitude and they are proclaimers of the truth. Now, time's our enemy, particularly this morning. We don't have time to go to Psalm 64. But if you went to Psalm 64 in the negative, you would read about men and women who open their mouth and send out bitter words. They don't care who they hurt. They don't care what they do to other people. They just sprout out anything. If it hurts you, bad luck. And in Psalm 64, it talks about bitter words being shot like arrows. So therefore, we've got tongues that are bent out of Psalm 64, and words as arrows are shot forth. There's the bow, brothers and sisters. Now, you know, there are the emperors of the first seal, the five emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. Let me go back there. I just want to see if there was... That's okay. I just wanted to see if Dan was playing around with my laptop and controlling it from up there. But he's not. All right, there are the five emperors of the first seal, brothers and sisters. We've already been introduced to those, albeit very briefly. Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius. 84 years of bow bending. Didn't mean to say the brothers and sisters weren't suffering persecution, but they went forth bending their tongues and sending out those sweet arrows. That is a potent weapon. That is a very, very potent weapon, the gospel. Now, here are the emperors, as we said, of the first seal. And they would be conquering the Roman world by the word of the covenant. Now, you know, when you read some of the historical statements, particularly LaRousse, in its historical record, pages 208 through 209, LaRousse says this. To everyone, the reign of Trajan, there, the second emperor and the first seal, it was like the return to the Golden Age. It was during the reign of Antoninus Pius, that the Roman Empire reached the zenith of its power and prosperity, and for this reason, his reign appears uninteresting and eventless. So if you went up to Antoninus and you said, how was your day? He says, yeah, it was all right. How was the office? Well, it was okay. Any problems at the board meeting? No. How was your coffee? It was all right. Nothing. Just uneventful. Nothing to talk about. So here was a situation where Marcus Aurelius, the last emperor, had absolutely need of domestic peace in order to carry out his foreign policy. And Gibbon, in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, if he could crystallise the events of this first seal, this white horse, what Gibbon said was this, brothers and sisters. If a man were called upon to fix a period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would without hesitation name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian, the hater of the Christians and Jews, the nutcase like Nero, to the ascension of Commodus, who would be the first emperor of the second seal, of the red horse seal. So there's Gibbon. It was just, if you want to pinpoint or earmark the most beautiful and happiest time, that's a historian. Not reading Eureka, not reading Revelation chapter 6. He said, that's it, the white horse period. What an amazing thing. Well, we read in verse 2 that a crown would be given to our brothers and sisters who would go forward in that period. Not a diadem, that's the kings. This is the Stephanos. This is the victor's crown who fight a warfare of faith. And they did, brothers and sisters. Even though the empire prospered and was at peace, nevertheless, the dominant force governing the period was a warfare of faith against terrible odds. But it's not carnal in our warfare. You know the words of the Apostle Paul when he talks about that in the 2nd of Corinthians. Here's an example of our brothers and sisters who lived in this period. Here's a letter to Trajan, one of the emperors of the White Horse period. And it's a letter from Tiberianus. And he says this. So obviously Trajan commissioned this awful persecution. He says, I'm quite wearied with punishing and destroying the Galileans or those of the sect called the Christians according to your orders. You've told me to wipe them out, but I'm getting tired of doing it. They're bowbenders. They never cease to profess voluntarily what they are. They are sending out the words of the covenant and nothing can stop them. We'll persecute them all we like, but they will still continue to bowbend. They're offering themselves to death because they are vigilant and determined to hold aloft the beauties of Christ. Wherefore I have laboured by extortion and threatening to discourage them from bowbending. But they won't. What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters. What an exhortation to you and me. And therefore the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 4 through 5 says, our warfare is not carnal, but we get inside the imaginations and the strongholds of men's minds. We get in there, brothers and sisters, expelling the darkness and bringing light. And when you look at the bow and you turn up the word bow in your concordance, there are some words that you might turn up and you think, well, I've read what the meaning of that is in the Greek and I haven't really been enhanced as far as my knowledge is concerned. Because when you read the word bow in Strong's Concordance, it just simply says the most simple of all apparatuses. Well, I knew that. I mean, a bow is just a bit of wood and a stick and a bit of string. I mean, that's pretty simple. When I know that, I didn't have to look at Strong's Concordance. But when you have a look at the word from which this word bow comes, it's used 29 times in the New Testament, 29. And every time, without exception, every time, the context is birth, a new beginning. So here is an apparatus that is the most simple, particularly if it hasn't got an arrow. It can't get much simpler than that, sticking a bit of string. The most simple of all apparatuses, which is the gospel. How simple is the gospel? And what does the gospel do? I know of no weapon, brothers and sisters, where you fire a weapon at somebody, you give them life. So here's a weapon. When you shoot the arrow at somebody, you bring them life, not death. That's the power of the bow benders as they brought the wonderful word of covenant to that world in that 84-year period. Well, worse is to come. We're now going to plummet from that 84-year window where I might say this, brothers and sisters, when the bowbenders went forth, our brothers and sisters preaching the truth, they began a process of weakening the pagan Roman Empire to the point where when Constantine would come on the scene in 312 AD, there was an easy road to removing paganism. So this was started by the bowbenders, the weakening of the pagan system. Well, we now move into the second of our seals, the blood red period. When it says, the record says, and there was a red horse, the word in the Greek means fiery red. Fiery red. It's like when you sever an artery, and that real rich deep red would be the color referred to here. Now, as we had in the first seal, five emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antonius, Pius, Marcus Aurelius, we also have five emperors in the second seal, Commodus, Pertinax, Julian, Septimus Severus, and Geta. Well, we read with respect. How's everybody going? Okay. No heads dropped yet? Let me have a good look. Pretty good bunch, you know. Pretty good bunch of Christadelphians. Well done. No questions. We've got no time to interact here, brother. Don't even think about it. Did you want to go back? There you go. Okay, got that? Right. I've got to apocalyptically time periods in this study, you see. I'll catch up with you later, Pete. Okay, the red horse, verse 3 through 4. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second living one say, John, come over here, be a spectator. You belong to us. You are part of us. We are going to rid this world over a 2,000-year period of all things evil and wicked. And there went out another horse in verse 4 that was red. And power was given unto him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. Now, that was the Machaira. It wasn't great because it was long. It wasn't long at all. It was great in its effectiveness. And as they flashed these Machairas, the effective assassinations that took place were very, very, very purposeful indeed. All right, brothers and sisters, there's the Machaira, the little stabbing stick and cloak and dagger stuff. That's where we get that expression. But you know, it's amazing when you read some verses in the Scriptures. You read in your English version, with respect to the second seal, that the word for sword is Machaira. That's verse 4. Have a look at your Bibles. You might have something in the margin. What's the Greek word sword in verse 8? Some of you would have this in your margins. It's Machaira, and it's the short stabbing stick or assassin's dagger in verse 4. What's the Greek word? Different Greek word, because it's a different sword in verse 8. Rhomphia. Well done. It's the rhomphia or the rhomphia. What's the difference? Well, one's an assassin's dagger in verse 4. The other one is a long Thracian sword of judgment. Now, their brothers and sisters are the rhomphia or the rhomphia. Why? Why does God say, I'm going to use the Machaira in the second seal, I'm going to use the rhomphia in the fourth seal? Was that just to give us a little bit of colour, a bit of variety? No way, brothers and sisters. Now, when you read Vine's expository dictionary, you read that this is the Thracian weapon, Liddell and Scott. This was used by the Thracians. Ah, now that's interesting, because tomorrow we're going to tap into this in detail. Now, there is Thrace, right there. And that emperor there is the first emperor of the fourth seal, in which this word sword, Rhomphaia, occurs. And that fellow there, whose name is Maximin, was a Thracian. And brothers and sisters, this man who would become the first emperor of the fourth seal would be the Thracian sword. So God knew that, and he's pouring history into the prophetic mould, and he just uses that sword with that word because of that emperor and what that emperor was going to do, which we'll pick up, God willing, in our study tomorrow. Well, in this section it says, or the second seal, that they would take peace from the earth, and Rome boasted in the Pax Romana. Nobody disturbs the peace of Rome. Nobody. Ask them in Philippi and Thessalonica. Nobody disturbs. And so therefore Rome guaranteed you peace. Or they'd come and take you by the sword. They'd come and take you as a country. But once you were taken and under the umbrella of Rome, you were guaranteed the peace of Rome. Well, those who gave that jurisdiction, those who gave those utterances themselves were taking away the very thing within which they boasted, the peace of Rome. And the record talks about that they would kill one another. Have a look at how that happened, literally in history, brothers, as the angels were working. Well, there are your emperors of the second seal, Commodus, Pertinax, Didius, Julianus, Septimus Severus, and Geta. 31 years of civil war. Now, Commodus, brothers and sisters, was absolute nutcase. He was. I mean, if you had a piece of fruitcake on the table, you put Commodus next to him, or it, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. He was a fruitcake, beyond all description. And you see, brothers and sisters, with Commodus, You see, with respect to the historians, they say this in LaRousse, that 3 years before his death, Marcus Aurelius had named as his successor his son Commodus. Well, there are the emperors of the first seal, and there are the emperors of the second seal. Now, there's Marcus Aurelius there. Now, he would, 3 years before his death, he would nominate Commodus, who was 16 years old when he was nominated to be the next emperor. 16! Which means when Marcus Aurelius died, Commodus is 19. Well, between the time he was 16 and 19, Commodus just sat around, didn't do much at all, just behaved himself. Everyone looked at him and said, oh, he's all right, nothing brilliant, but he's all right, doesn't get into trouble. But when he became emperor, brothers and sisters and young people, at 19, that power went to his head. And you read in LaRousse's history, page 210, he was incapable, was Commodus. He was a drunkard and he was a profligate. And a profligate is somebody who was extravagantly indulgent, as he was. At 19 years old, power at once went to his head and he demanded recognition and worship as God. Thought he was Hercules. He used to dress up like Hercules. He used to go into the arena and go, oh, Hercules! And all the arena would go on a great big Mexican wave, oh, Hercules! And he'd strut around, thrusting his chest out, and he'd say, bring on an opponent. Well, I'd send an opponent in. And he dispatched the opponent very quickly, because he's Hercules, you see. And he'd say, bring another one on. They'd bring another one on, and he'd go in a few seconds. This fellow is good. He really deserves the title of Hercules. And then another opponent would come in, and then another one. Anyway, the audience are looking down there, and they're going, there is something not quite right with this fellow. Because every time they saw an opponent come in, the opponent was not allowed to have a weapon. This fellow has lost the plot. As he had, brothers and sisters. He abandoned, the record goes on to say in historical records, he abandoned the reins of government to his licentious favourites. He renounced the energetic defensive policy of his father. He pillaged the treasury. He persecuted the Senate without mercy, and therefore, not unexpectedly, plots against his life were numerous. Coming home from the theatre one day, walking down a corridor between all these pillars, and somebody jumped out from one of the pillars with a machaira. And said, Commodus, you profligate, the Senate sends you this. Well, the assassination didn't succeed. Commodus overcame this assassin with a weapon. How, I don't know. He wasn't used to fighting people with weapons, but it was not his time. And when he heard that the Senate sent him this, he was absolutely incensed and enraged. And he went through the Senate like a corn harvester going through corn, like a wheat reaper going through wheat. He went berserk with bloodlust, did Commodus. Well, they got him in the end. They didn't stick him with a machaira. They throttled the life out of him by strangling him. And then the army put in his place Pertinax. Now, Pertinax, brothers and sisters and young people, was a senator of consular rank. Pertinax was as straight as a die. He was a virtuous pagan, if there was such a thing. It is reported that Pertinax had said, I would rather rule over a poor empire virtuously than over a rich empire corruptly. This man was going to straighten out the fruitcake. And brothers and sisters, he got into office, and he was in office, was Pertinax. He was in office for 2 days. 2 days! And the army wanted him out. That's not enough time to straighten out the office from the other bloke that's just been in there, brethren and sisters. 2 days! And they wanted him out. Well, he managed to talk the army around, and he lasted for just under 3 months. And they'd had enough of him. No perks, no kickbacks from Pertinax. This man is a virtuous pagan, and they wanted him out. Well, the Praetorian Guard are coming. 15,000 Praetorian Guard are coming, banging on the front door of Pertinax. Pertinax wasn't a coward, didn't flee the city, didn't hide under his bed, went out to meet them. Fellas, what are you doing here? We don't want you here. Come on, look, you've had the nutcase Hercules running around. Do you want to go back to those days? Settle down, boys. We're trying to get the empire on track. You know what a mob's like? Oh, I suppose you're right. Rhubarb, rhubarb. Now, all of a sudden, somebody in the audience says, nah, he's pulling the wool over our eyes. Nah. And so they leaned forward, did one of them, and thrust Pertinax with one of the machairas. Well, once one goes, all the rest jump in. I wouldn't say 15,000 got to him, but there was enough. He was a sieve. There was almost nothing left of Pertinax. The only thing they could find was his head. They got his head, brothers, and stuck it on a pole, and they were walking around Rome through the streets of Rome saying, who wants to buy Rome? They're auctioning the empire. They're not going down to the marketplace to buy a little trinket. They're selling the empire. People are shaking their head going, what is going on? Well, these two old blokes came along, they had their wallets, they opened them up. See how much money they had? Well, buy the empire. Yeah, I could buy the empire. I've got plenty of money. And one of the ones was Didius Julianus, rich fellow, old bloke. Look at the money I've got. The Praetorian guard said, that's good. So he bought the empire. Useless, bro. Useless, man. He was old and useless, but he was old and useless, brothers and sisters. And here you've got this old fellow now ruling, who couldn't rule for the life of him. And all of this is going on in Rome, and outside in the provinces there are three generals, one of which was Septimus Severus. Three generals trying to keep the Roman Empire together. It's all right, Dan, we're on track. We're even going to make up a couple of minutes, so I'm going to build up credits for the next study. Now, what you have, brothers and sisters, is out in the provinces, there are three generals, war-hardened veterans they are, trying to keep the empire together, fighting barbarians and all the things you do if you're a general out in the provinces. Now, they heard what was going on in Rome. And Septimus Severus liked Pertinax, thought he was a good fellow. And they, all of them, the three generals, started a march into Rome. Septimus was the closest. He's on the way. Now, in Rome, the Praetorian Guard, who were responsible for this mess, heard that there were war-hardened soldiers on the march. And these fellows in Rome, the Praetorian Guard, were as soft as butter. And they heard that Septimus is coming. Oh, we've better get out of the baths. We better stop watching DVDs. We better put on our armour and do some... Oh, I've got blisters. They were frightened stiff, brothers and sisters, as Septimus was on his way. Now, Septimus wasn't coming to set things right. He was coming to take Rome for himself. And in came Septimus Severus. He took the army that was there, the Praetorian Guard, and replaced it with his own soldiers. And then there was Geta, who was the son of Septimus Severus. Brothers and sisters, it's history, yes. But I tell you what, the angels are working, because the angels were going to fulfill that little quotation that they should kill one another. What an amazing thing. One little verse, and all of those historians could write reams and reams about one verse that is plucked out of Revelation chapter 6. Well, things, brothers and sisters, will get awfully worse. And God willing, in our studies tomorrow, as we look at the black horse period and the pale horse period, and then our brothers and sisters who cried from underneath the altar, we're going to see gut-wrenching events that would affect our brothers and sisters as this pagan Roman Empire plummets into oblivion. So God willing, tomorrow, brothers and sisters, our session will be seals 3-5, How Long, O Lord, Christ's Brethren Slain. Thank you.